AP Radio News. Good morning, I'm John Belmont. With Americans' opinion of Congress falling like a rock, NBC's Saturday Night Live opened by adding gravity to the government shutdown. A sketch with two stranded spacewalkers and everybody but the janitor furloughed in Houston.
Mission Control, we are at 4% oxygen and dropping. Please advise.
Mission Control is not here right now, but can I take a message?
What do you mean they're not here?
Well, this is awkward, but the government has shut down.
But the Senate is working today, its leaders taking up talks now that House Republican discussions with the White House have failed.
All eyes will be on Majority Leader Harry Reid and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell as the session gets underway to see if they report any progress in their effort to piece together an agreement toward raising the debt ceiling and ending the now almost two-week-long government shutdown. Reid and other Democratic leaders spent more than an hour at the White House yesterday afternoon, but said nothing to reporters as they left.
Capitol Hill correspondent Jerry Boatlander. Contract talks are set to continue today between BART and the two unions representing San Francisco Bay Area transit workers. Our Shirley Smith reports employees are threatening to strike for the second time in 3 months if no agreement is reached by tomorrow morning.
When negotiations broke off late last night, BART said that teams for each side would meet separately to prepare for a mediator to bring them back to the bargaining table. There's no word on how yesterday's sessions went, but BART's general manager did attend, and the unions said her presence made a difference.
Overnight trouble in Bellingham, Washington. Officials say hundreds of college-age kids who had a big party broken up threw stuff at police, who responded with pepper spray to disperse the crowd. Many arrests reported. New Mexico officials believe five teenage boys missing from a ranch for troubled youth are still in danger. A search warrant was served on the Tierra Blanca High Country Youth Program. This is AP Radio News. So the shutdown rolls on, but the gates are opening again at some national parks.
Welcome to Grand Canyon National Park.
It and others are reopening despite the federal government shutdown. Arizona and other states are using money from their own budgets and private donations to open the parks again. Governor Jan Brewer.
We made the decision quite quickly without any relentlessness at all to take $400,000 out of the Office of Tourism's budget.
The decision was made in part because of the amount of money that was being lost because the parks were closed. Arizona is being joined by Utah, Colorado, South Dakota, and New York in reopening key national parks in their states. I'm Diane Kepley.
Five Detroit pitchers combined to put together a one-hitter as the Tigers down the Red Sox 1-0 in Game 1 of the American League Championship Series. Detroit was within two outs of tossing the third no-hitter in postseason victory when Daniel Nava singled in the bottom of the ninth. I'm John Belmont, AP Radio News.
Do you miss the joy of reading because of blindness or disability? Here's great news about Choice Magazine Listening, a free talking magazine. You'll hear outstanding articles and stories chosen from leading publications such as The New Yorker, National Geographic, Smithsonian, Time, Sports Illustrated, and many more. Please call 1-888-7-CHOICE or on the web, www.choicemagazinelistening.org.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1-T-1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Google scans every single picture that you upload to Google Plus. What it does, it learns what your family members look like. It groups photos of your family members together. It can tell if your subjects are smiling. So if you've got a subject smiling in three photos, and one photo they've got their eyes closed and are frowning, it will take the face from a good photo and paste it into the bad photo so everybody's smiling.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having three number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Dana Theus, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin, Vistage Chair, and Jeff Parks, President, Performance Breakthroughs. Today's show is brought to you by the Potomac Company, helping employers manage the future costs of health care. We have a great lineup today, including Mike Sformo, CEO and Chairman, Operation Backbone, along with Cliff Benson, Chief Development Officer of the Buffalo Sabres. We have Dr. Valora Washington, President and CEO of the Council for Professional Recognition, John Elsroth, President, American Audio Video, and Greg Baroni, Founder, Chairman, and CEO of Attain. Starting off, we have both Mike Sformo and Cliff Benson with us, and we'll start with Mike. Mike, what is Operation Backbone?
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite, and it's an honor to be here, so thank you. Operation Backbone is a soon-to-be 503c nonprofit, and the basic premise is very simple, is our goal as Operation Backbone is to be able to bring wounded soldiers or veterans anywhere around the world into Buffalo, which is UBNS, University of Buffalo Neurosurgery, and then perform the brain and spine surgery he or she needs, and then post-rehab, which would be strength training and nutritional training with the Buffalo Sabres.
And why was it so important for you to help wounded warriors with this particular kind of injury?
Well, it wasn't so much the importance of trying to help the wounded soldiers. The real thrust for me was the lack of help that was out there for these serious injuries. That's what really was eye-opening to me, was a lot of people just assume that we get the best care there is.
And how did you notice this?
Well, after I hurt my back working out about 2 years ago, I had a severe back injury, and I went to the VA. And
because you're a veteran.
I am a Navy veteran, and I'm not retired, so I'm not entitled to all the great benefits, but I do have the benefit package. And I was told there's nothing they can do, either A, for reimbursement, or B, there's nothing they can do in the future to help me. So I jokingly said to one of the VA workers and my wife, what do you do if you have a severe brain injury? And they kind of looked at me, and that's when I realized that was my next calling in life, to go out there and make a difference. So having some great people on board in the brain field and in the spine field, and now with the Buffalo Sabres, we've created Operation Backbone, and our goal is brain and spine surgery to help the most severe cases and bring them in, give them the treatment that he or she needs. And the other thing, too, is it's also the mental aspect of how difficult an injury is, and I say it in the most simplistic way, is when people get up after a long day of working in the yard or driving and their back hurts, it's how difficult that is. Compound that with a severe injury, brain injury or a back injury, and on top of the financial burden that has to go along with trying to treat the injury itself and the paperwork and the spouse issues and everything that goes along, it's an overwhelming mental, it's a massive workload that people have to understand and adjust to. So that's why I said, if I can't even do this with my little back issue, how do others do this with real severe issues?
And you reached out to the Buffalo Sabres, and that's why Cliff is here with us. Cliff Benson, welcome.
Thank you, Dana.
What is the Buffalo Sabres?
Well, the Buffalo Sabres are a NHL hockey team. So we play your local team, the Capitals, several times a year. And I got involved with the Sabres as a second career after I retired from Deloitte in 37 years.
Could have just gone and played golf for the rest of your life. Why did you?
My golf game's not that good,
okay.
I wanted to do something significant. And Terry Pegula, my very good friend, sold his business at the same time, and we had both read a book about going from success to significance, and decided we needed to take the things that had made us both successful and go out and do some things that were important, significant, that helped other people, And what better platform than an NHL franchise to do that?
So is it about the hockey team, or is it about what you can do because of that platform, or is it both?
Yes and yes. Mm-hmm. We're both very avid sports fans. The Penguins were my client for 20 years. I know what it's like to see a city win a Stanley Cup, and we want to do that for Buffalo. But we also recognized we have a chance to make a real impact in that city, to really help causes, people, things that need help.
Give us an example. What can a sports team do to help people?
Well, in my role as chief development officer, I'm focused very much on the community. So we do a lot of things with disadvantaged kids, with skating. We're very involved in the public education problem we have in the inner city of trying to change the model of how those things are done. And the other main thing we focus on is veterans. As you know, in this country, we have 21,000 homeless veterans a day. We have, as Mike has pointed out, countless injuries that don't get dealt with, and we decided we're going to make a difference there, too.
So how did you two meet?
He showed up at my doorstep, and my security guy was asleep, is what happened.
You know, actually, I was always a big Buffalo Bills fan, being from Buffalo, and a Buffalo Sabres fan, and I never in my wildest dreams thought I would be sitting here with the chief development officer, or even partnered with the Buffalo Sabres,
Got him all the way down to D.C.
Yes, I did. But the goal was never, in the beginning, the goal was never to really just, you know, have a team on board. It was more of a learning curve for me, is to say, how awesome would it be for someone that was in the military and to be able to go on the ice and skate or be with a professional trainer from a real franchise and have that not only that admiration but that extra push and that attitude.
It goes back to that mental.
Yeah, that's what it, I said. It's one thing it comes from a doctor that says you have to lose weight or your blood pressure. It's another thing if it comes from your favorite player or if it comes from your favorite franchise. And that to me was the real draw. And I never thought they would even say yes or talk to me. So I was just stunned and fascinated and I'm thrilled.
And most people, Mike, would, with the thought itself, the question itself, would stop right there. So what is it about you that actually enabled you to just kind of go up there, knock on a door and say, we need to talk?
Well, I have a gift, as my father used to say. I'm a blockhead, and I learned a very hard rule in life that, you know, like Cliff mentioned before, is you just keep going and going and going and going, and you will find the right door that will open, and sometimes you get kicked in the face and sometimes you don't. But that was with the Sabres. People always told me, forget it, it's a waste of time, and I'm like, what's a waste of time of one phone call? So I approached, and I was fortunate enough to meet Cliff. And I want to mention this, too, also, is if it wasn't for Cliff, then the Buffalo Sabres wouldn't be involved. And I'm not saying it because I had the greatest idea in the world. I'm saying it is because that people like Cliff and others see what I'm trying to accomplish, and they understand what it takes. So it means a lot.
Did you play hockey as a kid?
No, I tried. I did.
You tried. What does that mean?
I got a hockey stick when I was little, and I really did try, but I never realized that you had to really put on ice skates, and I never skated before, and then that was my hockey career. It was pretty quick. So I think it was on the ice for 30 seconds, and then my dad said, that's it. I said, okay. So that was about it.
So what did you learn from that experience?
It's brought me to where we are today, is that if you decide to quit, and that's the result you're going to get. And I translate that over to Operation Backbone with so many of these soldiers that just say, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I can't do the phone calls. I can't do the payments. I can't do the paperwork. I can't do the travel. So I have been given such a wonderful gift, and I always say from God that he gives you the charge that you need. And the charge I've been given was to make this bridge with others so that people that are not able to do it can walk over it and really get the help and the admiration they deserve.
When did you realize actually that you had that gift, other than, you know, your reference to a gift from God as well? But when did you recognize you had it in yourself?
Well, I've had a lot of challenges in my life, and like I mentioned previously, I've been very fortunate and blessed by so many second and third and sometimes fourth chances by some wonderful people, and it's taken me a long time to realize how lucky I am, and I realized that this is a chance for me to give back to others, and it's an honor to work with the families and the soldiers that really do need the help.
You mentioned your dad as having a very strong influence on you as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else stand out for you in terms of along the way, as you've mentioned it?
Like I said, and I mean this sincerely, like with Cliff, there are so many people that I have come in contact with that don't have to give you the time of day and can simply blow you off. They don't need to work with you. But not only Buffalo as a whole, but the Buffalo Sabres have not only, they've given above and beyond what I've asked, and I push and push, and I've been pushed back, believe me, but that's part of the process. But it's, working with Cliff is, he's like my dad, and a long way, when I lost him to pancreatic cancer in 2 months, he saw the opportunity, and it's not by any means polished. It's just a very, you know, rugged view of what Operation Backbone was, and he was willing to roll the dice and take a chance. So I appreciate it.
So let's ask Cliff. Cliff, you, our audience can't see. You're a little older than Mike here.
A lot older.
Yeah, the dad thing isn't going over real well, but we'll deal with that later.
But you've stuck with him. What did you see in him? Why did you stick with this?
Well, I'm a get things done guy. That's the way I've always been. And I saw him and I said, he's a get things done guy, and he'll do what he needs to do. And what he's doing is a great thing. Mm-hmm. Veterans need some opportunities. And if he was willing to do the hard work, we're certainly willing to get behind him. We started a program in Buffalo called Sled Vets, for veterans that are handicapped, have lost the use of their legs. And we put them on ice on sleds. It's unbelievable. Because when they get together, they say, this is the first time I felt like the camaraderie I had in the military. So we understand that that works.
You're speaking a lot to that mental motivational
Absolutely.
Aspect of
mental,
this.
Mental motivational aspect. Big deal.
Which is interesting, coming from two organizations that succeed based on physical accomplishment.
Absolutely.
That's
yeah.
great.
Well, we've done the same thing with inner city kids and skating, and changes the way they think about themselves.
Mike, if your real father were sitting right here, what would he say about you? Would he be surprised at what you've done with this?
No, I think he would be actually very critical of why it's not further along and all the errors and mistakes I've made.
That's where your motivation comes
well,
from.
Well, it's yeah. just the way my father is, just a make-it-happen kind of a guy. But one last thing I do want to say about the veterans.
What's the website?
www.operationbackbone.com.
Sabres.nhl.com.
Thank you. We'll be right back after this Business Spotlight. We're here with Julie Simmons, President, Human Capital Strategic Consulting. What is Human Capital Strategic Consulting, Julie?
HCSC, or Human Capital Strategic Consulting, is basically a firm that partners with organizations to really enhance their HR capabilities. So we provide customized human resources solutions, anything from HR infrastructure, design and implementation, including HR outsourcing. We work with a lot of clients that don't have an internal HR department.
And what makes your business really special for clients to work with?
One of the things we hear over and over again from our clients is how flexible and customized our approach is to their unique businesses.
And why is that important, customized?
Because while each of us have employees potentially or contractors that they're working with, when it comes to human resources, organizations find it meaningful to be able to flex their HR infrastructure based on their current business needs. So in a market that changes pretty dynamically, it's important for an HR solution to actually flex with the business needs, and we're able to provide that.
And what do you love most about your job?
I love helping my clients solve problems. One of the most important things that we bring to the table is an ability for our business owners to focus on building their business and growing their business and doing their day-to-day jobs and letting us take care of the HR house, and we really enjoy that.
What's the website?
www.humancapsc.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. Next up, we have Dr. Valora Washington, President and CEO, Council for Professional Recognition. Valora, what is the Council for Professional Recognition?
The Council for Professional Recognition is a nonprofit that credentials teachers who work with young children in family child care or child care centers, preschools, or in regular school.
How big or small is it?
We're a $10 million organization with about 50 staff.
And why is it so important for you to help young children by helping the adults that work with them?
It's really important because we know that what happens with young children between birth and five is really very rapid brain development and so much learning. And it's really important that the people who are working with young children really know what they're doing and know how to stimulate children and help them progress mentally, socially, and in every other way.
And how young were you when the importance of children's young childhood experiences became real for you?
Yeah, I was about 10 years old when I realized that I was going to have a career as a child advocate.
10 years old, really? You were still a child yourself?
Absolutely.
What happened?
Well, there was a traumatic event in my neighborhood where there was a family with four children that lived over top of a bar not far from our house.
A drinking bar.
A drinking bar. And the bar caught on fire one night, and all of the children died. And at the age of 10, many of my questions about that were not answered. I couldn't understand why children were living over top of a bar and where were the adults at that time of night. And so at that particular time in the era I grew up, people really didn't answer children's questions. And I remember because the four coffins drove by our elementary school and the whole school came out to just have a moment of silence as they passed by. And I remember that very moment saying to myself, I'm going to grow up and make sure this never happens to another kid.
So I'm really curious, a 10-year-old with that strong of a conviction at that age, what did you do when you were 10, 11, 12 to act on that? Because you've done so much with your life now, but how did it first manifest?
Well, I grew up in a family where volunteerism and service was really important. And so even as a child in elementary school, I was also going door to door collecting money for the March of Dimes and that kind of thing. And so I just really was instilled in me at a very young age the importance of serving others and building community and working with others to get the change that we wanted in our community.
And how many brothers and sisters?
Well, I have three brothers, but I grew up in a very large extended family. So when you ask about brothers and sisters, that's sort of a difficult question for me because so many cousins and other people around that just were very close as we were all growing up.
And you tell a really interesting story about that community, about how it moved together state to state.
Yeah, I think many people today are a little more aware of the massive migration of black people from the South to the North. And I was actually the first child born in the North in my family. And a lot of people from my family's community in Georgia migrated together to Ohio. And so when I grew up...
You mean like different families moved together?
Different families moved together to Columbus, Ohio and settled in the same neighborhood.
And this was because they thought they would have more opportunity there?
Well, they were all friends from their country town and they moved together, grew together. Imagine the courage of people who move from, you know, a little rural community in the South, in Georgia, to move to a place they never heard of. They didn't know anybody there. There was no job waiting for them. I've certainly moved cross state many times, but you can be sure every time I've moved, I had a job and a house waiting for me when I got there.
Almost like an act of faith that you knew this could be, something could be better than where you were coming from.
Absolutely. And I think education was really important to that, and giving people opportunity was an important part of that. In the rural South where my family came from, there was no high school for black people. And, you know, we were really taught, not just me, but other kids in my community, that everything was possible for us. Mm-hmm. And we could do anything, and we could, and that we needed to serve and give back when we did it.
So where did that sense of responsibility come from?
The sense of responsibility is really the sense of privilege. I mean, it's not that it's a responsibility in a negative sense, like a burden. It's like an opportunity that you have to really work with others and to help them improve their lives. And that's what we do at the council. We're working with teachers who are very low paid, who are working with children from birth to five, who do not get recognition, and many people even think they're babysitters, and they don't understand the important role that they play in the lives of children. So it's a privilege to help these people, mostly women, improve the quality of their lives and help support their families and have professional credentials. That's a privilege.
Mm-hmm. So actually, take a moment and enlighten us. What is the biggest misconception about what those women are doing that we need to all understand?
You know, many people think it doesn't take skill to work with babies and toddlers and preschoolers. They think anybody can do it. And they don't understand how important it is that we provide very specific experience for children, that we really help children scaffold from one level of development to the next level of development, and that we do that by specific opportunities and skills and knowledge that we have about how children grow and develop and learn.
So I'm curious about the importance of adults in young children's lives. Who was the most important adult in your young life?
Oh, for me, it was no question my grandmother. I mean, she was just a very strong model of womanhood in the sense that she was a very strong volunteer. She had 8 children herself. She was a fabulous mother. I mean, I think that her children, grandchildren, and great grandchildren pretty much worship her at her feet, what she accomplished in her own life. She got her high school diploma the same year that I got my PhD in 1978. Don't you think that's amazing for someone who just continues to have that much hope and continues to press forward no matter what their life experiences have been?
How are you most like her?
I think I'm most like her in the sense that I really look for opportunities to be of service. And I understand that even with our employees, as well as with the 30,000 people that we credential every year, that we're touching each and every person at a very core level, at the level of their life. And that's a privilege that we have.
How are you unlike her?
I think I'm unlike her in the sense that I have come to realize that I cannot do it all. And I think that women of that era really did it all. I mean, she was a very strong leader in her church. She was a very strong leader in her community. She was a very strong leader in her family. And, you know, nowadays I try to pick one or two.
You have a little more time for yourself, maybe?
Absolutely, but not that much.
Yeah, I can imagine. How the strong community that you grew up in really intrigues me, because so many of us don't have that. And I'm wondering, how has that impacted your work as you've gone in to create many organizations, actually? How does community come in to that work you do?
Yeah, one of the important things that I've done in my career is really develop cohorts of leadership opportunities for people who are early educators. And what we try to do in these as cohorts of leaders is try to be architects of change for young children, so that we, with our knowledge base, are influencing the policies that surround child life and early education. And what I learned as a child and what I practice now is that when we come together and we work together, we can make a difference. We can change policy. We can change practice. We can make a difference. And I know that you do that when you work together with other people.
Did you ever have a doubt in your mind at any point in time that what you're doing might not be what was your gift? I mean, did you ever question yourself at all? Because you're so powerfully inclined to run this track that you've been on.
I think it's part of the era also of growing up at a time where there were so many opportunities for leadership, for learning, for contributing, that, you know, really this mindset that everything is possible, that you can make a difference. There's no reason for doubt. We all make a difference.
So if others are hearing your story and inspired by it, what steps would you suggest that they start with to start down that path?
I think it's really important that people start with their everyday challenges. Look around you and see what's going on and what's wrong and what you can fix. And then find a community that you can work with in confidence, that cares about the same things you care about in your everyday challenge. And then think together about how you can act upon those challenges to make a difference, how you can advance and accelerate change in those areas. But you start with your own everyday challenges.
What advice do you give to the people who struggle to find the opportunity in their everyday challenges?
That's when you really need to work and talk with others. So if you don't know where to begin, find somebody else who is facing the same thing you are. I mean, you know, we're also of an era that has birthed so many support movements. And what the whole thing about support movements is finding strength in community and learning lessons through the experiences of others. There's always an opportunity for change.
And there's always someone that you can reach out to who
Absolutely.
Will reach back.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
There's hope.
There's always hope.
Mm-hmm.
If your grandmother were sitting here today, would she be surprised at your success?
No. Not at all. You know, I think it was really, again, part of that era and being part of a generation where there was an expectation that we were going to go out and be a credit to our community and that we were going to be of service. I think that was the expectation. And again, it was the opportunity. So I think that she would say, yes, those lessons that I learned at church, at home, in the community, that they stuck. And I've stuck with it.
And if you could tell her one thing, what would you say?
Love is really at the core of everything we do. You've got to love people. You've got to care about people. That's the bottom line.
What's the website?
Our website is www.cdacouncil.org.
This is Dana Theis with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this Business Spotlight. I'm here with Todd Meyer, Business Performance Advisor at Insperity. Todd, what is Insperity?
Insperity is an organization that is an HR outsourcing organization that works on the people side of businesses.
What makes your business special?
We tailor our solutions for each individual client, so I would say that it's being fluid and flexible for what their actual needs are.
Why is that so important?
Well, so we can be reactive. People are probably the biggest part of the business, and so and to be reactive in a certain moment that we're able to tailor solutions, positive or negative, to the business.
So who's your perfect client? What are they looking for?
It's a mindset. Our perfect client is someone that has a strategy about their people, willing to look outside the box and willing to focus on their core competencies and put things behind them that they aren't experts in.
What do customers appreciate so much about working with you?
Well, I think being a consultant, that if we don't have the resources, we're able to look inside of our book of clients or as other resources to bring to the table to how to solve their business solutions.
What do you love so much about your job?
Meeting CEOs and individuals on a daily basis, and every one of them I've found it has a different set of goals and solutions and or problems.
What's the website?
www.insperity.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. Next up, we have John Elsroth, President, American Audio Video. John, what is American Audio Video?
American Audio Video is a company involved in presentation technology for meetings and conferences, events, dinners.
And how big or small is it today?
Our company has 25 employees, and then in the busy times, which is fall and spring, we balloon out to about 60.
And it's also kind of a promotion. You're doing events and promoting events?
No, we're primarily the technical backbone for an event. So if you need a PA system, say you're having a nice dinner and awards dinner for your employees, and you want to have a nice PA system, you want to have some projectors and screens to show the faces of your awardees and so on, we provide that hardware.
And how young were you when you first started putting on shows?
Oh, well, with this business, I was 22.
But you started putting on shows earlier.
Oh, sure. High school. I mean, we were, I was on the stage crew, and I actually was the projectionist at the local movie theater for...
And where was this? Where did you grow up?
This is a corn and soybean town in southern Ohio called Blanchester, Ohio.
So you decided not to be a farmer. You wanted to put on...
I'm always interested in farming, but that wasn't the direction I ended up taking.
Tell us a story about your first promotion success.
We were promoting a musical, Music Man, for the high school. And we got the idea that one of the music teacher had an airplane. He was in an airplane club, so he had access to a single-engine airplane. So we thought, well, if we print a couple thousand brochures up and take them up and spill them out of the airplane down onto the village surely that will increase the attendance at the musical.
Everybody will want to come.
So we did. So we printed a couple thousand brochures, and we went out to the airport, and we got in the airplane, and we went up in the airplane. We're flying over the village, and the first thing I realized was it's kind of hard to push an airplane door open when you're cruising without falling out, and when you're cruising along at 80 or 100 miles an hour. So we push out the flyers, and they go billowing out of the airplane into this large column, but the wind is blowing, and they're not coming down on top of the village. They're coming down on the farms, you know, and the soybeans and the corn.
Who can't attend performances?
No. So we did get one muddy brochure back at the box office, I think.
So were you a kid that always had bright ideas?
I don't know that they were all so bright, but definitely no shortage of ideas. Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have a brother and two sisters.
And where are you in the pecking order?
I am second of the four.
So how does being kind of in that middle of the pack, how has that shaped your career?
You run between the, you know, your older and younger, you know, your ice breaking older sibling, you know, and your younger ones who probably aren't getting as much attention as you did, because by then
they're little.
You're there, right? So for me, it was a balance between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I think you end up being something of a mediator sometimes.
And you had said something to Dana in the green room when we were talking about this. You said that unique thing you brought to the table in running your company was about keeping the company in balance. And here you are describing as the second of four.
Yes.
Where you're doing the same thing.
Yes. I think when you run a company, you know, company is sort of an entity that's in balance between several different constituencies, between your employees and your customers, your government, your community, your suppliers. And they all have somewhat adversarial agendas. And so to effectively manage a company, you have to keep these in balance to keep the company successful.
When did you know you could actually do that well?
That's a tough question. I don't know that I've ever completely mastered that, but it's definitely a goal that I work on. You know, you realize that the cost and the time and the attention of each of these entities has to be in balance with the other. Otherwise, the company gets pulled to a direction that will drive it into not unsuccessful.
I'm curious, though, because you don't hear executives talk in those terms very often. You hear them talk about profits and, you know, the goal of the company is to maximize the profits. And you're saying that to be successful, there are other things involved that may help you achieve that goal. How did you come to that appreciation?
Well, all of these elements are needed. They're all essential.
They all have value.
They all have value. But they all don't necessarily talk to each other.
Is that a core of what leadership brings to the table, is the ability to pull these things together and put them at the table?
That's probably valid. That's valid, because I think good leadership brings people to compromise and sort of sands off the extremes.
And when you first started this company, you were doing it with your brother.
Yes.
And he was a very active part of the business.
Yes,
so
he was.
Were you partners?
Yes, we were. And we did the initial marketing together and the initial technical skills. He's a very, very technical, skilled guy. And so a lot of that value added was coming from my brother.
What did you learn about yourself when he left the business?
That's probably where the concept of balance really came in. I realized that he was a balancing force in the company, and that I needed that, and I couldn't do without that.
So
his skills had to be brought into the company through some
other means.
Some other means, absolutely.
And as a leader, you identified that and made sure it happened.
Yeah, you know, it's partly by, I would love to say it's vision, but it's also partly by necessity. You know.
But we also heard some of that from your mediation, maybe mediating squabbles when you're growing up. But we also heard the entrepreneurial and kind of autonomy streak in you. Where did that come from?
Probably primarily from my father, or at least my father's side of the family. He comes from a fairly entrepreneurial lineage, if you will.
You said he had multiple jobs.
My father himself had multiple jobs. He started off as a graphic artist. He became a school teacher. Then he got into educational development of programs. He had a number of jobs. And
did you ever work with him?
Yes. Yes, I did.
In what capacity?
He actually worked with me between a couple of his jobs at American Audio Video.
Oh, really? He was working at your current company?
Yes.
Oh, what was that like?
It's pretty good because he brings a lot to the table. He's good with people. He's good with sales. He's fairly detailed.
Did he ever challenge your authority as the leader?
No. Not at that time.
Did he at another time?
No, I mean, I suppose as a young man, he certainly probably had his doubts about which way I was going. Yeah, but
why was that? What was he doubting? Do you think?
Well, I was off sort of on a non-standard trajectory. You know, I'd come out of university, and now I was starting my own business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the first lesson you get in mediation and balance is you think that you're going to be your own boss, and you quickly learn that now
you're
everyone, everybody is your boss. And
right.
So I think that my family was a little surprised that I was off on that track.
Does his success surprise you now?
Yeah, a little bit. You look back and you go, boy, if it weren't for that, or if it weren't for that, or if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be here. You know, geez, there was some lucky moments.
So it's not all just hard work.
No, it's not hard work. I mean, there's definitely luck and timing that come into success, without a doubt.
What do you think he learned about you that he didn't know when you were growing up that shows up now in what you do?
What my father learned?
Yeah.
I don't think he thought I was as tenacious as I am. And I think that at a point he realized that I wasn't going to give it up, I wasn't going to stop, and I wasn't going to go into a more traditional setting. And then he sort of threw up his hands and went, that's where we're heading.
But yet you learned that from him. Did you ever share that back to him, saying, you know, hey, I got this from you?
You know, that's poignant. No, I haven't.
Can you?
Yes, I can. You know, he's an old man now. He's 88. I don't know if he would allow me to call him an old man. He's pretty spry.
We won't tell anybody.
But yes, I still have that opportunity.
He'll learn when he listens to this interview.
If he were sitting here right now, what would you tell him?
I would tell him, thank you. You know, thank you for showing me that there's always an opportunity.
What's the website?
We are www.aavevents.com.
This is Dana Theis with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Park. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
Are you really confident you've assembled the strongest team to work with you on your business? For example, an attorney who has successfully handled your type of problem, an accountant who sees the big picture, a business advisor who gets it, a real estate broker who really knows the market, a commercial insurance broker who really has access to all the different insurance products, an employee benefits guru who really helps mitigate future costs, a wealth manager who works with you to make work optional, an understandable information technology wizard, a commercial banker with minimal covenants, an investment banker who believes business is a relationship, not a transaction, a staffing specialist who can really help you build the team, even a confidential peer group with whom to compare notes. Listen to executiveleadersradio.com, that's executiveleadersradio.com, to confidently select a business leader who serves business leaders to help you. Because nobody's interviewed more business leaders from Princeton through Northern Virginia than Executive Leaders Radio. So you'll have confidence in your choice of a business leader to help you in your business, in your ultimate selection of this business leader. This business leader can include your attorney, an accountant, a business advisor, a real estate professional, a commercial insurance agent, an employee benefits specialist, a wealth manager, an information technology guru, a commercial banker, an investment banker, a staffing specialist, a collection agency, even a CEO club. Save yourself grief, time, and money. Listen to executiveleadersradio.com. That's executiveleadersradio.com. So you can listen and learn from the most highly respected professionals. executiveleadersradio.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks. Next up, we have Greg Barone, founder, chairman, and CEO of Attain. Greg, what is Attain?
Attain is a strategy, management, and technology consultancy. We, for the most part, serve the public sector markets, which are like the education, healthcare, and government marketplaces.
And how big or small is it today?
Today, we're about 250 people.
And this experience grew out of, you have a long history of working in the consulting arena.
I do.
You've had several jobs and several iterations there. Why is consulting so captivating for you?
Well, I really learned the business of consulting when I joined Pete Marwick Mitchell back in 1982. So it was quite some time ago. And I spent 20 years there. And through that entire experience, I became a student of history in terms of what the consultancies did, what set them apart from one another, and the different genres of them, and what I thought the direction was of the consultancies. And so I became one of the leaders, if you will, of the consultancy business within KPMG.
Within KPMG. And now that you have your own consultancy, you're very principled about how you go about it. The
yes,
principles and values are very important to you. Where did that idealism first come out in your young life?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I think when I was growing up, making a difference was a really important thing for me. I guess I was very fortunate to kind of grow up during the time period I grew up, which was at a period of time when there was a lot of civil unrest in our country.
Did you see any of that in your life?
I certainly saw some of that.
What did that look like?
Well, in the high school I went to, for example, that civil unrest manifested itself in racial riots.
And where were you growing up?
I grew up in Southern California, and the high school I went to was one of the pilot integration schools.
So you had riots on your high school campus?
On our high school campus. It ultimately shut our campus down for about a week each time.
And what was your role? I mean, what did you end up doing in this crazy time?
Well, during that time, I, obviously from my standpoint, I felt that I wanted to make a difference in trying to bring people back together.
As a mediator?
And ultimately was selected as one of the student mediators.
And where did that skill come from? Where does a high school student get a mediation instinct?
I don't know whether it comes as an instinct. I think people see skill sets in you and they say, this individual will be able to get others to follow them.
Who saw that in you?
I would say between my parents who saw it in me and then school administrators who saw that in me. I was fortunate enough to have it become one of the skills that I was able to develop.
So what were mom and dad doing at that time in your life? What were they keeping them busy during the day?
Well, unfortunately for me at that time, I grew up in a household that was split. And so I actually, interestingly enough, was raised by my father.
So what age were you when your parents divorced?
My parents were, I was actually 12 years old mm-hmm. at the time. So it was a very, you know, obviously something like that changes your life rather dramatically. And you get the chance to see how people persevere through a very difficult challenge.
So when you look back on it, that difficult experience as a 12-year-old, how has that affected who you've become today?
I think these principles, which are, if you feel, if you kind of look at that, for example, experience, it's a unfortunate situation where a covenant is broken,
mm-hmm.
Which means trust is broken. And unfortunately, you learn, geez, you just don't want that to happen because your intimacy with that individual, whether it's a parent or a relationship with a friend, and maybe even a spouse, is premised on trust. And the ability to fulfill those commitments and keep them is really important to the foundation of creating a relationship that has sustainability to them.
And it's interesting that you appreciate the value of trust because you saw it broken.
Mm-hmm.
How can you help people appreciate those principles without violating them? What's the strategy there as a leader?
You know, you have to model them. You have to realize, and I tell you, it's something that I had to learn over time.
Where do you remember learning it most vividly?
During my time with KPMG.
Ah.
I mean, and I can't even say that. I could probably even say even I was fortunate enough to love my alma mater enough, which was the University of Southern California, that I actually stayed there and worked there and rose to a position of leadership early on. And it was there that I began to learn that as you grow into leadership roles, you have a responsibility to those that you lead, and they're depending on you. It's a commitment. And so they look to you as the role model of what they ultimately would aspire to be for themselves.
You said you grew up with your father. Was he a role model for you?
He was absolutely a role model for me.
How?
And you know, I learned a lot from him. I learned just how important it was to really sustain and keep a family together in spite of the fact that it's a broken one.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from your mom?
Oh, that's a really tough one. I think what I learned from her during the time we were together as a family was the importance of nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
going back to what you were just describing about your dad and the influence that he had on you, do you have other brothers and sisters as well?
I do. I have two brothers and a sister.
And where are you in that order, so to speak?
I am the oldest. So if you think about a divorce situation, you become like the secondary parent when you're the oldest.
So this gift of responsibility, so to speak, fell to you?
It sure did. And I tell you, it's again there where you asked the question earlier about where do you forge your principles in life. It starts at an early age when something tragic like that happens in your life. You learn, hey, what are the important things in life? And your kids, I mean, not your kids, your siblings are looking to you for leadership because you're the oldest around at the time.
So you mentioned also in having started so many businesses and that you've learned the value of taking risk, not just in business but in life, and yet you're talking about responsibility. How do risk and responsibility play well together in your life?
It's a balance. You know, and I actually don't think of either – I don't think of those two things, risk and responsibility, as being mutually exclusive.
In what way?
Well, I think risk doesn't mean being reckless. Risk means, frankly, you can take measured risk. You learn that you, through the process of undertaking any venture, you identify the risks, you put mitigation plans in place, and you forge forward. And why do you put mitigation plans in place? Because you have a responsibility to the people you serve.
That's great. Where did you first get that insight? Did you have mentors that helped you realize these things?
Yes, I did. I mean, I think, as we talked earlier, I always aspired toward leadership. And part of it just was a responsibility that you assume in a family, but part of it was the situation I was put in high school and later on in college and then early on in my career. And I was blessed enough to be put in those positions and assume the role.
The message, do the right thing, is what we took away from the green room. How do you make that come alive on a daily basis?
Well, making do the right thing come alive is really is, again, comes back to being a role model. You have to live those core principles. If you want people to follow them, they have to see them in action. It can't be just a glossy brochure in which they read about them. They have to see the leader not only just living them, but passionately living them. And so that's how we put them to life.
So take us back to the days when KPMG was going to make a big divide, and you fought internally for a change that happened.
Right.
And you took responsibility for that change, but then things kind of didn't work out the way you imagined.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, and tell us about what it's like to see something that you fought so hard for not come to its greatest dreams and potential.
Well, it was, so let me kind of, you know, take you through a little bit of that story. You're absolutely right that I was one of those leaders that forged the separation of our consulting business from the audit and tax business.
To become Bearing Point.
It became Bearing Point after I left. Now, that was another story. So I stayed there 20 years. Successfully watched us go through both the separation, and then the next part of the business model was to go public.
Mm.
Timing wasn't the best, because by the time we went public, unfortunately, it was at a time when the bubble had burst in the dot-com era, and our valuation coming out of that IPO process was about one-fifth what we anticipated.
One-fifth.
So it was a very challenging period. And
80% less.
80%. You are correct.
I just want to do the math.
You're absolutely correct. So now you say, well, why did you push that forward? And we really believe there was a first mover advantage by being the first of the consultancies at that time.
Taking
to do
a responsible
that.
Risk.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say, and it's not fair for me to say, what caused the demise of KPMG Consulting, because I left shortly thereafter. I had been part of an organic buildup of a consultancy for 20 years. I wanted to be then next part of a transformation. And so I went to Unisys to transform an old, staid hardware business into a new breed consultancy. And that's why I left and joined Unisys.
So what's the soundbite about success and failure from that experience for you?
I think the soundbite is laying the foundation for success. And it goes back to the three principles on why we set up Attain. Next generation, which we wanted to really be fused as a new breed company. Core values, a core ideology. And finally, built to last, something that would transcend time and people.
What's the website?
The website is www.attain.com. Please join us.
And that's a wrap. This is your host, Dana Theus. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mike Sformo, CEO and Chairman, Operation Backbone, Cliff Benson, Chief Development Officer of the Buffalo Sabres, Dr. Valora Washington, President and CEO, Council for Professional Recognition, John Elsroth, President, American Audio Video, and Greg Baroni, Founder, Chairman, and CEO of Attain. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Jeff Parks, and our sponsor, The Potomac Company. And I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, because without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also listen to this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government.
Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.